Good morning. Good crowd. We don't have these kind of crowds in here. Maybe two or three and the lawyers. That's about it. So it's great to see all of you this morning. Well, this will be the start of our second day of oral arguments. We have three cases set for this morning. The first case is David and Marcia Earl versus Farmers Mutual Insurance Company of Nebraska, appeal number 30732. Ronald Parsons will be arguing on behalf of the Earls, and Justin Clark will be arguing on behalf of Farmers Mutual. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and Mr. Parsons, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, and my good friend at counsel's table, Mr. Clark. In the movie The Shawshank Redemption, Andy Dufresne, who was wrongfully convicted, escapes from Shawshank prison by tunneling through the concrete wall of his cell using an old rock hammer darn near worn down to the nub in less than 20 years. The narrator is a fellow prisoner named Red, played by Morgan Freeman, is explaining how Andy was a student of geology, imagining that it appealed to his meticulous nature. Geology is the study of pressure and time. That's all it takes, really, pressure and time. Those of us who go to law school tend to have meticulous natures as well, and one of the great joys of being a lawyer, and I imagine being a judge, is to trace and follow the evolution of precedent and see where it's been, see where it is, and see where it may lead. And that's also what it takes for precedent to evolve, pressure and time. The pressure of cases that arise, that are brought, that require issues to be resolved, re-examined, and refined, and the time to see how that's going to develop. Sometimes precedent is a straight line that one can follow exactly, and sometimes it zigs and zags in different directions as tensions are resolved and the tectonic plates of the law move around before it reaches a logical equilibrium. And that's what brings us here today to the well of this magnificent courtroom in our great law school, where our clients, Scott Abdallah, and my clients, David and Marcia Earl, the surviving parents of their beloved daughter, Rebecca, are seeking the re-examination of precedent, and specifically the curious case of DeSmit Insurance Company versus Poyer.
So, Mr. Parsons, in your brief, you say either distinguish Poyer or overrule it.
Yes.
Is there any basis to distinguish Poyer from this case, or are you really asking us to overrule?
We're asking Poyer. You to overrule it, Your Honor, but there is a basis factually to distinguish it. Poyer was not a wrongful death case. Poyer involved injuries to an insured who survived. The under insurance statutes speak in terms of the party recovering. And the party recovering in a wrongful death action are truly the beneficiaries of the wrongful death action. And so that is a factual distinguishment of those two situations. It's different, and the court could rule on that slim basis. And we would ask that they do so if you're inclined to stay with Poyer.
Should we decide, as you suggest in the brief, to reverse Poyer, when we look at whether or not to overrule precedent, we're going to look at the five factors outlined by the Supreme Court, and I'd like to turn your attention to the reliance factor. To what extent has Poyer been relied upon? And it clearly states that the owned but not insured exclusion does not violate public policy. Haven't insurance companies relied on Poyer for that proposition when drafting their coverage agreements?
I think, Your Honor, to some extent, yes. I think the reliance factor is really the reliance on the principles of the precedent. And Poyer really sets forth a no standard. It's an assertion that the language subject to terms and conditions might justify this particular exclusion. But there's no discernible principle in the case to rely on for determining what terms and conditions are okay, what terms and conditions are not okay. It's really a non sequitur. You can have terms and conditions, so you can't do that. But you can do other things. I have other exclusions that are terms and conditions. So really the reliance factor, I would suggest, is low, although you're correct in terms of current policies that have been drafted. But this court's always made clear in addressing stare decisis that the important thing is the workability of a rule, that if it's something that is erroneous, inconsistent with our other precedent, subsequent developments have shown it to be erroneous, the quality of the reasoning in the decision, which I would suggest in Poirier is poor, respectfully. All those things I point to the court seizing this opportunity to set things right. Of course, it's never something the court does lightly. I understand that.
We also have recognized in the effort ways we contemplate, which really isn't that common, when we contemplate revisiting precedent, correcting a decision we think was wrongly decided, we have at times, like the U.S. Supreme Court, kind of reflected on the source of the public policy. So, for instance, in In re Nom, as you know, we recently held, because our interpretation of a constitutional provision was at issue, we felt that that was perhaps more compelling in terms of the need and the necessity to revisit public policy. Why? Because, of course, constitutions are hard to change, even though we have direct democracy in the state. Still harder to change than legislative policy, which is relatively more accessible in that respect. This public policy that's at the heart of this case is sourced to the legislature, not the Constitution. So your thoughts about that?
Well, it's sourced in the text of the legislature. It's also sourced in the cases this court has that have interpreted that text. Now, before Poirier came along, Glow had established several things, Glow and other cases of this court. One was that underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage is mandatory. Another is that it is portable. That's one of the mistakes the Poirier decision makes. It talks about increasing the coverage on a particular vehicle. Uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage is not on a vehicle. It's sold with a vehicle, but it covers the insurance, and it stays with the insurance wherever they are, even if they're walking, even if they're a pedestrian, not in a car. But if they're injured in a motor vehicle accident, suffer bodily injuries or damages that are uncompensated, that's when the coverage kicks in.
Counsel, I'm sorry. So in Poirier, in this footnote 4, you know, there's a lot of the emphasis is on this subject to terms and conditions, but there's that extra sentence at the end of the 9.5 statute that Poirier notes that, and I don't, this isn't an exact quote, but it refers to the limit of coverage or limiting coverage to the coverage on the vehicle of the party recovered. So, and that's different. That's something distinct that we don't have with the uninsured motorist provision. What does that mean in your view? And how do we, you know, we have to give meaning to all of the terms. What does that mean?
That is I would suggest doesn't address the substance of the coverage, the substance of the coverage that's provided, but the amount. And so the amount that is given of underinsured coverage is determined by the limits in your policy. So I would suggest there's no meaning beyond that in terms of whether an insurance company can nullify the requirement of mandatory coverage.
So if you have one vehicle, that's just referring to limits, whatever that particular vehicle means?
That's my interpretation, Your Honor.
I don't know if it necessarily appeared that the Poirier decision was referring to it in that way, but I wanted to hear what you thought about that.
Yes. I would suggest that the mandatory nature and the portability of underinsured and uninsured coverage controls, and that's how you determine the amount. And of course, there's this argument saying, well, what if you have a car, a vehicle that's owned but not insured? Aren't you trying to somehow get away with not paying the premiums? Well, if we see in this case, you're talking about $11 for another vehicle. But it's also, you know, you could never have this scheme where you have all these uninsured vehicles because it's limited to the amount of coverage that you have on your vehicle, as that statute says, and you get a credit for any other thing. The insurance company gets a credit for anything else that's recovered. So the only way a second policy ever comes into play, or even potentially a third, is if the insured has purchased more coverage than the other policy. And so really, if you get uninsured or underinsured coverage under one or two or three policies, that's because you paid more in a different policy to get more coverage. And you should get what you pay for.
So you've talked a little bit about the subject to terms and conditions in the 9.5 statute, which was a real big feature in the Poirier case. I don't think the statute cited in the briefs, and I don't know that we've talked about it in our cases, but SDCL 58-11-10 was enacted in 66 with the uninsured statute. Says a policy said at that time, a policy may contain additional lawful provisions not inconsistent with this title subject to the director's approval. They modified that in 2010 prior to Poirier and Wheeler and said a policy may contain additional lawful provisions including reasonable policy exclusions. Does that statute apply to both underinsured and uninsured? And if so, does that make a difference in terms of the significance of the subject to terms and conditions section?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because that's talking about all insurance policies. And insurance is, as a general matter, in a liability policy, is a matter of contract between the insurance company and the insured. It's uninsured and underinsured coverage where that changes, where the statutes become part of the contract.
Right, but my point is, if that's part of the coverage, underinsured and uninsured, and in that chapter, and it says you can have lawful provisions, including reasonable exclusions, they got to be lawful. So that would seem to apply equally to both underinsurance and uninsurance.
I would respectfully disagree, Mr. Chief Justice, because the statutes say it's unlawful not to provide uninsured and underinsured.
Yeah, my point is, though, it seems to bring underinsurance and uninsurance on the same plane, and maybe that language in 9.5 subject to terms and conditions doesn't matter that much.
I would disagree. It brings it on the same plane because it's unlawful not to provide, it's mandatory, it's unlawful not to provide uninsured and underinsured coverage. You have to do it if you sell a motor vehicle policy. And so I would suggest that statute you cited contemplates that, because only lawful exclusions could be provided.
So what is the reason then, in your view, why the subject to terms of conditions are in one and not the other? Because we have to give meaning to it. And what are scenarios where that would apply?
Before Poirier, Glow had said these statutes are applied interchangeably. Poirier said, well, we have this different language. But as Justice Zinder said in his concurrence, is that really what the legislature intended, that by saying they are subject to terms and conditions, that you can nullify the coverage merely by christening an exclusion as a condition? I don't think that language should be given the effect it's been given to allow the nullification of coverage. What I think it means is that clearly an insurer can place terms and conditions on the coverage. Who gets it? What the limits are? All these policies, terms and conditions that are in an insurance policy. But what it can't do is remove coverage.
But do you have a rationale why it's in one and not the other?
I don't think there's a basis to say that. And as Justice Zinter points out in his concurrence in Wheeler, uninsured motorist coverage is subject to terms and conditions, a myriad of them, as he says. So it's inconsistent to say that uninsured is different than underinsured. It's never been treated that way because both are subject to terms and conditions.
What's the purpose of the 9.5 statute? If you have, let's say, the 9 statute and the 9.4 statute are a pair and they correspond, what do we get from the 9.5 statute?
The 9.5 statute, as Justice Devaney pointed out, sets the limit.
Right, besides that.
And part of the reason is they were drafted at different times.
So
they may be looking to do the same thing but use slightly different language. They were drafted 9 years apart, and the underinsured coverage was amended later. But as this court said in Glow and I believe, implied at a minimum in Streff, that does not mean you can deny mandatory uninsured or underinsured coverage by christening an exclusion as just a term and condition. In Kaiser Trucking, this court recently explained very thoughtfully the difference between terms and conditions of a policy and exclusions, which nullify it. You know, a lot of times insurance companies use subtle differences in policy language to, you know, to try to nibble away at coverage in sheep's clothing. That's not what this is. This wolf comes as a wolf, to quote Justice Scalia. This is a nullification, a frank nullification. You have underinsured coverage, yeah, no matter where you go, unless you're here in this type of vehicle. We gave ourselves a get-out-of-coverage-free card on this one. That's inconsistent with the statutes and the intent of the statutes.
And so it's your view that's a violation of public policy.
And of the language of the statutes, which make it mandatory.
And so Justice Zinner called directly upon the legislature to clarify this state's policy regarding the uninsured and underinsured motorist insurance coverage that is required to be provided under our statute. And they haven't. The legislature hasn't spoken.
That's, yes. It's been about 12 years since that concurrence came out, so very little time. But effectively, as many courts have noted, the pressure put on by a concurrence in a judicial decision on a legislative body is very, very hard to measure. It's really zero pressure. If you ask the members of the South Dakota legislature, well, what do you think of Justice Zinner's 2012 concurrence in Wheeler, you get a blank stare. They haven't read it. So to assign significance to legislative inaction, legislative silence, legislators don't overhaul the insurance code for many, many reasons, political reasons, inertia. To give that controlling significance as to why we should not correct what we view as an incorrect interpretation of the statutes and the law, I think many courts have said that's a very thin reed on which to try to salvage an erroneous decision.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Clark, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. This case is a tragic one. There's no doubt about that. While the underlying facts of this case and the loss of Rebecca Earle's life is tragic, this case presents a question that has been decided by this court before. The answer to that question has been made clear by both this court and the legislature. In the context of UIN coverage, the owned but not insured policy exclusion does not violate the public policy of South Dakota. The circuit court based its decision on this court's binding precedent and ruled that the owned but not insured exclusion is a valid limitation on UIM coverage. Therefore, despite the Earl's arguments to the contrary, this court should affirm the circuit court's grant of summary judgment to Farmers Mutual Assurance of Nebraska.
Now, is the public policy that's represented by uninsured motorists and underinsured motorists identical, with the only difference being one of degree, not kind, or are they distinctly different?
Thank you, Justice. I believe the underlying purpose of UIM and UM coverage is similar, to provide uncompensated damages, to award damages to a party that's been injured. The difference being, in the case of UIM, obviously there is coverage from the tortfeasor involved. In UM cases, there obviously is no coverage whatsoever. So that would be a distinction between the two.
So let me follow up on that. Let's set Poyer and the the uninsurance case slips my
Wheeler?
Wheeler, thank you. So Poyer and Wheeler side by side. They're looking at, in the uninsured case, you're looking at the 9 statute, and the underinsured claim, you're looking at 9.4, 9.5 statutes. They seem inconsistent with one another in terms of how the result they get to and the way they view those statutes. Can you reconcile those for me?
Thank you, Justice. I believe that you can, and that is based upon statutory interpretation of the specific language of talking about subject to the terms and conditions. Now, I understand that...
Well, but the subject to terms and conditions, that really begs the question of what's the public policy in these two statutes? Subject to terms and conditions just means if it's lawful, you can put terms and conditions in it. That's what the legislature said. The question in my mind is, what's the difference in the public policy between those two statutes? And is there a difference? And did we identify those differences in Wheeler and Poyer?
As I mentioned to Justice Salter, Your Honor, I believe that the distinct difference is the limits of coverage. UIM, you have a recovery. We're providing you the difference with the UIM coverage. UM, there's no recovery at all from a tortfeasor. That you would be left without any recovery but for the statute. So I think there is a distinction between the two. To that point, Your Honor, you talked briefly about the Wheeler decision and the concurrence from Justice Sinter. In Wheeler, in the opinion, this court specifically proclaimed to the legislature that if this court has misinterpreted the legislature's intent in determining that farmers' own but not insured exclusion is void under SDCL 58-11-9, the legislature is free to clarify its intent. And again, Justice Sinter was very pointed in his question, is this really what the legislature intended? Now, the lack of change to these statutes and the legislature's silence is a deafening answer to that question. And I make that point because the statutes have remained exactly the same since, and the legislature has not altered or abrogated the decisions. This is important, I believe. We talked about a little bit about legislative acquiescence in the Earl's reply brief. They contended that that's a weak argument to support that the legislature would agree with the outcome of a statute's interpretation. That argument is based upon Justice Scalia's position on the issue, cited by an Iowa dissent. That's the case cited in their briefing. But contrary to that dissent's thoughts on the subject in that Iowa case, the majority in that Iowa case stated, "We presume the legislature is aware of our cases that interpreted statutes. When many years pass following such a case without a legislative response, we assume the legislature has acquiesced in our interpretation." That's State v. Lee, 6 Northwest 3rd, 703. The Iowa Supreme Court went on to state that stare decisis is especially applicable where the construction placed on a statute by previous decisions has been long acquiesced in by the legislature. In that case, the Iowa Supreme Court concluded that the legislature had acquiesced in the court's interpretation of the effect of its statute and declined to overrule its earlier precedent. Now, legislative inaction is especially important in the context of public policy arguments. As this court stated, the legislature is the final arbiter of public policy, and that was in Stratmeyer v. Stratmeyer. And indeed, as this court is aware, after its decision in Cimarron in 1992, there was legislative action immediately following that decision. And this court noted that in the MGA Insurance Company versus Goodsell decision, and I quote, "The legislature acted quickly to prospectively alter our decision in Cimarron." That happened in the very next year. So to say that the legislature doesn't know about decisions by this court, I believe, would be incorrect. It's well aware.
Assuming for a moment that we were inclined to overrule Poirier, Tell me the reasons that you think the principles of stare decisis might suggest that we should avoid that inclination.
Thank you, Your Honor. The factual scenario, I believe, in Poirier is identical to the case at bar. So there's no factual differentiation. There's been reliance upon this decision in Poirier and the court's holding of the owned but not insured exclusion to not violate public policy by insurance companies to include this in their policies and rely upon it when issuing those policies. I believe those are the strongest positions while the court, as far as the practical matters, should uphold the decision.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about the public policy justification underlying your view. If the purpose of underinsured coverage is to protect the insured person rather than the insured vehicle, so it's portable, the coverage is going to travel with the person, as we recognized in GLOW, what is the policy basis from the perspective of the insurance company justifying the limitation on coverage when an insured person is not in the vehicle covered by the policy when they are injured? What is the public policy reason justifying your view on how these policies should be interpreted?
Your Honor, with regard to the UIM statute and its applicability with regard to the exclusion, the language, I'm just going to pull it directly if I can. So in the exclusion, there's no coverage for you, your spouse, or a relative if you're not covered under this policy. For that reason, there would be an unknown on who would be covered in that specific situation that Poirier points out. The vehicles that we don't know about that would be covered then if there's an injury in that vehicle that aren't covered by the policy or by the policy issued by the company. They're not aware, they're not writing for that, they're undertaking a risk and not receiving premium for that risk.
Do you have a response to opposing counsel's suggestion that there's a subject to terms and conditions is something other than an exclusion, that exclusions are something different?
I do, Your Honor. As Justice Sinter wisely stated in his dissent in Streff, the payment of a premium does not entitle an insured to unconditional coverage. In the absence of a statutory mandate, coverage is governed by the policy terms. Policy terms include exclusions. This court has stated, in order to ascertain the terms and conditions of a contract, the court must examine the contract as a whole and give plain meaning to their words. Terms include exclusions.
But then we kind of just circle back to the same issue, don't we? But it has to be an exclusion that doesn't violate the public policy.
Correct.
Behind the statute.
Correct.
So when we look at the meat of the statutes, again, going back to the 9 statute, the 9.4 and 9.5 statutes for underinsured and uninsured, I look at the 9 statute, it requires two things. Number one, an insurer has to provide a policy of insurance with the liability coverage for underinsured coverage. Number two, the coverage has to be provided for the protection of the insured for any injury they're entitled to recover against an uninsured driver. Then you look at the 9.4 and 9.5 statute together, again, requires underinsured coverage for a motor vehicle in this state, number one. Number two, the 0.5 statute requires paying its own insured for any uncompensated damages as its insured may recover for death or bodily injury arising out of an accident that exceeds policy limits. I don't see a difference in those in terms of what's required in those statutes between underinsured and uninsured coverage. When you get into the meat of the statutes, what's the difference in your view in those statutes and those coverages?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe looking at the two statutes, 9.4 and then 9.5, obviously 9.4
4 is more closely resembling 9 for the UM. 9.5 is an additional requirement, but it does, as I mentioned.
You could argue it almost requires more in that it says you have to provide this coverage. It has to provide this amount of coverage to the underinsured driver.
Yes, that's specifically what it states. I would agree with that. Now, with regard to this situation in particular, having two vehicles insured, one being Ms. Earle's vehicle that she was occupying while she was killed, and her parents' vehicle also being insured, both having UIM coverage. I point out for the court's consideration, SDCL 58-11-9.9. It talks about, regardless of the number of policies involved, vehicles involved, persons covered, claims made, vehicles or premiums shown on the insurance policy, or premiums paid, in no event may the limit of liability for uninsured motorist coverage for two or more of the insured's motor vehicles be added together to determine the limit of insurance coverage available to an injured person for any one accident. I believe that also states public policy involved in this situation.
Is it a term and condition of a policy, an uninsured that offers underinsured coverage, is it a term and condition to categorically exclude a group of a class of claimants that would otherwise be subject to the protections of public policy, so that if you stacked a whole bunch of these sorts of exclusions, the public policy wouldn't just be undermined, it would kind of suffer the death of a thousand cuts. If a carrier could just peel off one category, call that a term and a condition of coverage, maybe peel off another category, whole categories, categorically. Is that a term and condition of the policy or the coverage, or is that bigger and broader than that?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I would consider that peeling off an entire group of vehicles, maybe, or in the case of government-owned vehicles in particular, I can understand that. But that's not what this restriction does, the one at issue. It's the language does not exclude an entire group of vehicles or class of persons, insofar as that language would, such as government vehicles would do. I believe that's distinguishable.
If you have anything you want to wrap up with, Mr. Clark,
thank you,
go ahead.
I would just point out, since Poirier, again, the legislature has made no changes to the applicable statutes to abrogate this court's decision. Therefore, this court should reject the plaintiff's request to ignore that binding precedent of Poirier and overrule it now. Respectfully, Farmers Mutual requests that this court affirm the circuit court's grant of summary judgment to Farmers Mutual. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. The public policy, as this court stated in Glow, and I believe in Strauff, of both the UM statutes and the underinsured statutes, is to fully compensate the insured. That is the public policy. It's identical for both. There is no distinction. And really, if the legislature is presumed to be aware of the Wheeler concurrence, the legislature is also presumed to be aware of this court's ruling in Strauff after Wheeler, where the same argument was made regarding underinsured coverage, that we can exclude government-owned vehicles because that's just a term and condition, and it's subject to terms and conditions. And that argument was unanimously rejected. No, you cannot exclude an entire category of vehicles. That's not a term and condition. That begs the question. That denies coverage, the fact of coverage, not the parameters of coverage. That denies the fact of coverage, which is what what exclusions do. Terms and conditions define the parameters of coverage. And I must disagree with my friend. Owned but not insured vehicles assuredly are a class of vehicles. It's a smaller class. But you're chipping away and saying, it applies, it's mandatory, it's portable. Unless you're occupying this type of vehicle, unless you're struck by this type of vehicle, under the principle of STREF, which the legislature is presumed to have given as much accord to as the Wheeler concurrence, the legislature could take comfort in the fact that there's already been a quiet revolution against this asymmetrical, illogical dichotomy where owned but not insured exclusions violate public policy for uninsured motor vehicles but are perfectly fine for underinsured motor vehicles, when the policy is the same, to fully compensate the injured victim. And it could be much worse, and as this case shows. You could have an uninsured person where there's a broken arm and there's no insurance, but they have $10,000 in damages or $15,000 in damages, so they can be fully compensated. Or you could have a tortfeasor with $25,000 in coverage who, at 100 miles an hour, plows into our client's poor daughter while he's trying to evade the police, and the damages are immeasurable for the loss of her companionship and the amount she's been uncompensated or her family has been uncompensated is a mountain compared to the trivial nature of a broken arm. So this is the opportunity I would suggest for this court to take advantage, which I believe it has already signaled in STREF by rejecting the subject to terms and conditions argument for the exact same reasons we are asking the court to do so. Correct the sharply divided, really illogical 3-2 decision in Poyer, which assumed underinsured coverage was specific to a vehicle when it's really specific to the insureds, and bring us back into alignment with GLOW, which says these statutes are applied interchangeably because they have the identical public policy, that it's portable, that it's mandatory, and the result in Wheeler and the results and rationale of STREF. I suggest that the logical flow of the law leads us there very respectfully. It is the hope of the Earle family that Poyer will be overruled. And hope is a good thing. Maybe the best of things.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.